Welcome, yes, welcome. This is Phone Show Chat 895, and no, your ears are not deceiving you. This is Steve Litchfield, back from semi-retirement by kind permission of Ted and Joe. I had a chat with an old friend and favourite of the PSC podcast, Juha Alakahu, the guy from Nokia behind the Nokia 808, Lumia 1020, etc. He's now consulting for a firm called IO. EYEO, who have a revolutionary and a genuinely impressive new way of creating camera sensors that capture 70% more light in potentially in future smartphones. We're looking a couple of years in the future, but it's a great glimpse into what might be. So if you're not interested in camera imaging and phone imaging, then perhaps skip this show. But we have about 35 minutes or so of imaging related chat as pertaining to smartphones of the near future. And it's, I think it's pretty interesting. We go through an introduction to the main guy behind the company, and then we're slapped back into me trying to get my head around exactly what's going on, how this new nanophotonics technology works. So grab a cup of coffee, brace yourself, and here we go. So I'm here with two guys, Juha Alakahu, who I'm getting better and better at that pronunciation, I think.
Yeah,
people will know his name from the Lumia 1020 and Nokia 808 days covered on the podcast many, many, many years ago. But he's the creator of the Lumia 1020 and I think probably the 920 and the 808 before that, all of those devices. So hi, Juha. How are you doing?
Hi, Steve. Good to be here. Long time no see.
With you, we have your, I think, your current boss. Is it Jeroen? I don't know your surname.
Hoot. It's a very Dutch name, unfortunately.
Okay, maybe Juha can send the spelling of and your name through back channels. Tell us a bit about yourself. And your company is called AEO. Is it AEO?
IO. So from eye opening, because essentially we let the sensor see more. So it's eye opening IO. That's where it's coming from. Yeah.
So it's an English joke.
It's an English gimmick. Yeah.
It's spelled EYEO for people listening to this. Tell us about how your background over the last 10, 15 years and how you got to create the company and the idea. Tell us about that.
All right. So nice to meet you, first of all. Happy to be here. So my background is obviously in imaging and in chip design. So I spent quite a few years designing chips myself, but then later moved more into product management roles and then business line management. So initially I started in a startup company called iCSense, where I did chip design. Later I went to KLA, a fairly bigger company, where I was running a business line of products using cameras. So then I was more a user of sensors. And then after that, I joined Kyliste, a company which is specialized in developing custom image sensors. And did that up to about a little bit more than 2 years ago, 2 years and a half ago, when I was in contact with IMEC, when I met Jan Genoe, Professor Jan Genoe, who is the inventor of the technology of color splitting that we're using today. And for me, it was an eye-opener. For me, it was immediately the solution to a key problem that this industry has been facing. So decided to leave my position at that time. And I spent about 1 year at IMEC, essentially to establish the company, to assemble a team, find investors, find suppliers, partners to work with, and even first customers. Essentially then to leading to end of 2024 when we started the company together with co-founders. And then we raised first money exactly 1 year ago, 15 million. And that's then to develop a first prototype and a first product, which is well on track. And then actually 2 days ago, we announced another 40 million investment Series A round, which we closed, which is essentially even to speed up because we see a lot of interest from the market and we want to capture that momentum.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So your company, IO, just to give people an overview before you go into detail, it's a new sensor technology, and which essentially gathers up to 70% more light. Is that a fair summary? Can you explain this? On your website, it talks about a nanophotonic technology. As I understand it, and I'll go back to the Lumia 1020 here, in fact, the 808 before that, these UHAR, if I understand it right, they use true RGB sensors. There's no quad bay or anything. So the light hits a grid of red, green, and blue filters, literally at the pixel level. And then software, in the Lumia 1020's case, or hardware, in the Nokia 808's case, famously, then oversamples and combines these colors into what it thinks is the true image. In modern phones in the last 10 years or so, we've had quad Bayer filters. So rather than being as sophisticated as this 1020, you have a grid of four greens, four blues, four reds, etc. And so the software is gathering in color information in blocks of four, and then it uses algorithms to try and work out what the colors are of the individual pixels. There's a lot of wastage going on, a lot of wastage and a lot of computation. And I'm assuming this is kind of the solution that you're trying to fix with this technology, Jörn. So how does your nanophotonic thing fit with these comparison to these quad Bayer filters? And how on earth have you managed to make it so, how has the invention managed to make it so small, and tell us how it works?
Yeah, indeed, it's a good question. So I think we are solving two aspects. So the two that you mentioned, the first one is the basic filter itself, because as you mentioned, you have a green pixel, a red pixel, blue pixel, determined by the filter on top. And so the problem is essentially that if the light hits the, for example, the green filter, then only the green portion of the light will go through into the CMOS, and the red and the blue is essentially blocked. So you throw away two parts of the spectrum, two-thirds of the spectrum is gone. So that's the first thing we solve. So we are not filtering any light to see color, but we are splitting the color in the different color components, and then we inject them into separate pixels. So the result is now we didn't throw away anything, and so it's not even just 70% better, it's times three better. So it's really a huge step forward in the amount of light that is collected inside of the pixel because of this. And then the second thing we're solving is essentially today they use indeed quad Bayer, and you have even nona cell and tetra cell if you combine 4x4 pixels like this. The reason why that is being done is because if the smaller you go in a pixel size, and definitely if you go below 1 micron in pixel size, the effect is that, let's say, your photon is actually bigger than the square of the pixel where you want to get it into. And so if you would not do any binning, any combination of pixels, then you would lose even more light, because the photon would essentially, only a part will be on the red, but actually the majority will still be captured by green and blue and be filtered away. So the loss, if you go smaller in pixel, exponentially increases. So the second property of the technology, and that's where it makes it also very appealing for smartphone, is that in the structure, we're not only splitting the light in color, but we're also compressing the photon into a smaller size. And so now we end up with a photon that is, let's say, in different colors, guided into different pixels, but also at a size that actually fits a 0.5 micron pixel. And so now you don't need to bin it anymore in quad Bayer or what you want to call it, but still get maximum performance. So you didn't have any loss associated to that. And that then also relaxes a bit the computational needs, because if you combine these 4x4 and pixels, yeah, you have a bigger interpolation to do on pixel level, which complicates again the software part. So let's say it fundamentally from the start, from the input, resolves the filtering and also the need for this binning.
So how large are how large are the pixel splitters sitting above the sensor? How large are they compared to a traditional pixel, a traditional quad Bayer block of four? How many subpixels are your nano splitters covering? So I understand it.
Yeah, so today you have, one splitter splits the color into the light into two parts of the spectrum, so two colors essentially, and so we inject it into two individual pixels below. So you have to imagine one structure sits on top of two pixels, And then we have two versions of the structure. So we create again four colors. So two times one color, and then the other one is a set of other colors. So at the end, we again have four colors, but yeah, let's say without any loss of light.
Okay, so the light hits the top splitter, which splits it into two, and then each of those two goes into another splitter. So you end up with four buckets at the bottom.
No, so it's a bit easier than that. So it's really one splitter at the top. So the photon hits the top of the splitter. It's then guided down, split into two parts, and then injected into two pixels. And that's the end of that chain. And then we have a second splitter just next to it, which is designed differently, which again collects one photon, splits it into two other colors, and inject it again into two pixels.
You get kind of four different color outputs. So there is like normally RGB, but here you are kind of splitting it in two different ways. So you actually effectively get like four different signals.
What are the four different colors in terms of frequencies?
So let's say you can compare it to blue, yellow is one pair, and the other one is cyan, red.
Okay, so this is a very different system in terms of what the algorithms will be expecting when they read your sensors. How are these sensors going to be read in terms of in putting them into consumer products? What will it need at the hardware end?
So indeed, you will have to do some different processing of color, of course, because we don't start from the RGGB the industry is known to. On the other hand, we already have a processing pipeline up and running where we only had to change a minor amount of building blocks. So we can actually do, to simplify it, a color conversion in the beginning, which then converts it into kind of red, green, blue again, and then you continue with the rest of the pipeline. So you can go quickly into a compatible mode, I would say. And if you do it in this way, you immediately have the three times more signal, so that you always get, and then you have the color performance of the RGB color quality, I would say. The reason why we chose these colors, is because it's actually matching more the human eye response. So effectively, we are already closer to what you want to represent in your picture. And if you look at an ISP pipeline, it starts from RGB and then you go to a YUV space. Let's say the color space where we start from is already closer to that YUV space. So over time, our customers, they can also start implementing new algorithms that skip parts of that RGB flow, and then also get a better color performance out of the chain.
What resolution sensors are you envisaging for this? Have you actually made any sensors? And if so, what resolution?
So we're currently the first evaluation kits that they're currently running through the foundry as we speak, and they will be delivered to first customers after the summertime. That's more of a demonstration unit. It's a small 1 megapixel imager, but that's more to demonstrate the difference, the comparison between the filter and the splitter. But it's already using a fairly small pixel, so a consumer grade pixel. And then later in the year, we will be releasing higher resolution variants going up to 64 megapixel of a similar pixel and a similar technology.
So if I've understood it right, for a 64 megapixel sensor, you would be using 16 million nanophotonic splitters. Is that right?
32 million even.
Oh, because of the two to one. Okay. Okay. How are these tiny, tiny little, I presume, then it can't be glass, surely. How are the nanophotonic splitters made? What are they made of? How do you create them?
Yeah, so it's a combination of silicon nitride and silicon oxide. It's essentially what is also being used in silicon photonics platforms. So you can even find that back in transceiver, laser receivers that they use in data centers, for example. So it's a fairly known CMOS material. And with that, we make indeed a kind of a, small We call it waveguide. So it's essentially a waveguide, so a funnel and a waveguide, in which then the photonic operation happens. And let's say the challenge is definitely, and that's of course one of the it's part of the knowledge we have and the experience we have built, is how to create 32 million of them on a small space, aligned and linked to individual pixels. And so that's of course one of the key elements of the technology. It's something that was developed within IMEC over the last 6-7 years now. So it's already well established how to do that. But that's indeed one of the key elements of the invention.
Is it made at the photonic splitters and the sensor itself, the photoreceptors, all of that is created in one layer, one process then?
Yeah, so you need multiple steps to process this, of course, but you can imagine, or you can see it a bit similar as how the CMOS chip itself is made, or even how they make today the color filters and the micro lenses. So it's also a set of process steps additional on top of the wafer.
Yeah, if I'm asking questions in which I seem a bit to be floundering around, it's because every single person hearing this and in the future years will say, what? How on earth are they doing that? How does this work? There's going to be a lot of question marks, I think. But so we've covered how they're made, and you will eventually get up to consumer phone resolution, because people these days, they do expect 24 megapixels, I think, as a minimum. That's what the iPhone standardizes on. So we're looking at that kind of resolution. How long do you think it will take you to get to that resolution shipping to real consumer phones?
So that's definitely an interesting question. So let's say from the technology point of view, to apply it on top of that kind of resolution, that's essentially what's already happening in the next several months. But then it's more of a for the next generation device, and that's also where we raise new money for, is we have to add more functionality again in those imagers itself, because the phones, the smartphones, they have many features inside of the chip, inside of the sensor, to enable them to exploit the whole toolbox of image quality at the end. And then, of course, it's also about demonstrating ramping up into volumes at high yield at the cost level that is required. So that will take steps for us as a company as well to establish that. So that's ongoing. But let's say in the next, let's say by 2029, 2030, time frame to be in a phone, I think, is a good target and a realistic target for this kind of technology.
Yeah. So we're talking, if people wouldn't see this in a consumer phone probably until the end of next year, start of 2028. Is that?
Yeah, well, probably because there is a trajectory to go through, yes, let's say, including also supplies and everything. So let's say, I would say more end 28, 29 time frame.
Okay. But when people, they now talk about Quad Bayer, and everyone knows what Quad Bayer is. What's the official title for your system? Nanophotonics?
No, so we branded it the NCOS, nano color splitting technology. Indeed, NCOS technology. So just to show that it is indeed splitting color instead of filtering color, which is really the fundamental difference.
Okay, Juha, what's your role in all of this? What do you do?
I'm a full-time employed in Axon still. So I'm an advisor for IO. But I've been now involved with you guys maybe like a year or something like that.
Yeah, I think even a bit more than a year.
Even a bit longer than that. And when I first talked to Jero, and was like, I was thinking like, there aren't so many things you can currently do with image sensor. Like the quantum efficiency of the image sensor is already like in the 80% or something. The noise floor is like one or two electron. It seems very mature technology in terms of light performance. So I was thinking, when Jeroen was talking about this, this is the last mystery to solve in the image sensor. I want to be involved in this, and once we stop throwing away 2/3 of the photons, it can have radical improvement in the image sensor technology, and this is really like the last mystery to solve in the overall image sensor low light performance. And I'm of course helping with overall image processing and how could we best implement this in products, smartphones, and several other products. So,
yeah,
doing my best to make it happen.
How expensive is this going to be in terms of the physical component? Say for a phone manufacturer in 2028 that is implementing an NCOS sensor in their camera phones. We'll stick to phones for the moment. How will the cost of your sensor compared to a standard, say, current Sony sensor?
Yeah. So what we see is the amount of process steps, the amount of process layers that we need is reasonably similar to what you do today with color filter and micro lens. So of course today the cost is higher because we are not yet at volume and not yet yield optimized. So currently the cost is higher, but over time we don't see a reason why we cannot get the cost down to similar levels even. But that requires going into volumes and improving the yield as you do for any phone. Yeah. So that's something we need to do anyway. But then there is a big improvement anyway, which is that because we have three times more light, because we shrink the photon and everything, yeah, we need less space. We don't have to bin anything to get to these 24 megapixel effective resolutions. So it means that your actual sensor can become smaller again for the same performance. And then, of course, you win on cost because, at the end of the day, it's really the size of the chip, which is driving the cost, not only of the silicon, but the complete module and everything. So the cost aspect is something we can definitely get under control for smartphone. For our first markets, our first products that we're introducing, we are introducing them into more higher quality or higher, more expensive camera markets where the cost is not so challenging yet.
Yeah.
And where there is also a willingness to pay more for a sensor that basically offers a much better product at a higher price. So also for the starting point, we can justify a higher price because of the extra performance you get.
Yeah, I'm just looking on your website and it talks about, in addition to consumer electronics, you've got automotive, so putting it into car cameras. I bought a car 2 years ago. And I'm staggered by the number of cameras it has around the front, the things it's photographing and the sensors it's triggering all the time. So there's lots of imaging in cars. You've also got medical imaging, which I think is what you're talking about then, when you're the price of a product, the camera is insignificant compared to the rest of the medical hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And security again, where you're. So all of these things, of these four categories, consumer electronics, automotive, medical imaging, and security, you think that, can you rank them from in terms of your priorities and the time scale on which they'll come into the market for you with NCOS?
Yeah. So the first products, let's say we focus more on the surveillance, smart city, security space, because of the very obvious impact it has in low light environment. The fact that we have three times more light, it essentially means that in darker environments, the sensor will collect more info and with color. This is an obvious market and also the first products that we will bring into the market, and that will happen in the next year, will be targeted for this segment. But at the same time, we do get requests from automotive and medical and so on. For I think also obvious reasons, if in a car you can have again in lower light better detection of objects with color in the street, it can make a difference for an ADAS system to recognize a bag from a rock, for example, or anything, and then make a different maneuver based on that. So we're also exploring if the sensors we already bring into the market can also serve their needs if it fits the right resolution or anything.
Yeah, I'm quite excited by your contention, quite rightly, that you can now get a camera sensor and thus the whole camera body and lens in the phone world can be a lot smaller for the same quality. Now, that may sound like you're not actually gaining quality, but by making everything smaller, you can eliminate, in theory, some of these camera bumps, because even mid-range camera phones now, they have a camera bump that's 2-3 millimeters. because of the literal size of the cube that houses the camera. But if you're going to get this exact same quality with NCOS technology, and the whole camera cube could be, say, half the size, you wouldn't need a camera bump. Phones would literally be slabs with no protrusions, and they wouldn't wobble when you put them down on surfaces.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And that there is definitely a big driver for that. And I think there is also another benefit you can imagine is, for example, the front-facing camera, where today you have a notch in the screen to house the camera itself. Already for a while, people are trying to put that camera behind the screen, but the screen itself is also filtering light.
Yeah.
So now we can then make a camera that doesn't filter any light with the display in front, which then filters light, but the overall performance may still be the same, with the difference that now there is no notch anymore. The camera is just behind the screen.
And so how come nobody's thought of this before? This sounds revolutionary.
Well, people have attempted to eliminate the color filter in the past as well. So there have been other attempts. So it's not an easy problem to solve. So I think the fact that the problem is there is very known, but the solution to it is far from an easy problem to solve. Where other methods have failed in the past is, for example, if they needed very exotic process steps, which are not CMOS compatible, and then you end up in the problem that if you want to ramp it in volume, it's difficult to get it under control. So that's something we do differently, is that it's compatible with existing CMOS production flows. But so we have seen attempts in the past fail because they changed too many things to the process, which complicated it. And the second part is, many of the other attempts were maybe more kind of prism based, I would say. So where you have light coming in, and as you know, a prism, it scatters it in kind of a rainbow out, to then project it onto pixels. But then one of the issues is that you have a lot of color crosstalk, and then you need a lot of computation, and that computation in itself introduced a lot of noise again. And still today, people are trying that route, did not manage to get away from color filters because of that.
I'm Juhai, going back to the dawn of camera phones. I'm thinking Nokia 7650, Nokia N70, all those the very first cameras in smartphones. They still used micro lenses and RGB sensors, didn't they? And I know we're not talking about color bin, quad bay or binning or anything, but they all used micro lenses on their sensors.
Yes, correct. So the micro lenses have been obviously existing in sensors as long as I can remember, and they all of those sensors used basic Bayer RGB, that has been the kind of bottleneck. There has been some smartphones that have been trying some alternative color patterns, like replacing one of the greens with white. But the benefits of that haven't been significant enough to take it like a mainstream. There have been some other problems. For example, if you have one white pixel, that then overexposed sooner than the other three, and that creates problem in the auto exposure. But with IO, you don't have any of this, let's say, the overexposure problems. So effectively, all of these pixels are equally sensitive.
Yeah, this is kind of revolutionary. If you tell people, by changing the sensor technology to sort of quad Bayer, etc., with micro lenses to NCOS, you can get 70% more light captured. It would blow people's minds. This is literally eye opening for me to follow your branding. This is amazing.
Or 3x like Kiroen said. So 70% versus 3x. Like it's actually even more than 70%.
Wow. Yeah. This is really impressive. So I wanted to get this on the podcast so that the whole community could find out, have a heads up that this technology was coming down the line. And I do wish you well with it. Just take us through, just very, very briefly, what in terms of your own personal technology, Juha, what are you using as your main smartphone right now?
Hey, I have iPhone 17 Pro here. Okay. With this nice arc bumpers. But hey, I switched from iPhone 13 Pro to 17, and they're kind of a, you know, it's five generations, and if I put them side by side, the difference is
I know.
Relatively incremental. So personally, we need some. I feel like we need something like IO. make a jump. One of the, another thing I'm quite excited about in the kind of photography space myself. I'm doing lots of kind of this true HDR output photography. Like for example, Lightroom has really nice support for like true HDR, like tuning and going like wider than white. And when you use it correctly, I think that's like a nice impressive thing that has been really making my own photos better recently. But yeah, I'm an iPhone 17 Pro Switch, five generations, and I don't know what is my next one. Maybe I don't know, iPhone 20 something.
Well, you've got to wait till NCOS hits the iPhone.
I guess so.
Presumably, you'll be talking to Apple at some point, Joran.
We can, of course, not disclose that. Yeah.
What are you using as your main smartphone at the moment?
Well, yeah, so I hate to disappoint, but it's the same as also the iPhone 17 Pro. So I've also been an iPhone user for many, many years. I use it a lot when I explain to people what the impact is, because one of my previous ones, if you compare it several years ago, there was not even a bump and it was all much smaller in the camera side. So I would love to see it again, smaller, but then outperforming today's quality of the picture.
I've 17 Pro Max, but I completely agree with you. I've also got an iPhone 14 Pro Max and going back an iPhone 11 Pro, and I can't tell the difference really for most light conditions. These huge sensors and these huge lenses, and all hopefully to be reduced by end cost in years to come, but they're only really to cover the edge cases where you're taking a photograph of your child in low light or trying to take video of a concert or something. And that's when these new latest phones and latest technologies and latest sensors, that's when they kind of come into their own. But for most purposes, the cameras in most phones now, Juha, I would say you can buy a $200, 200 euro smartphone, and in 90% of light conditions, it will take 90% the photographs that you need. You just don't need a flagship.
Yeah. Well, one other thing I would like to maybe highlight here. I like one thing I don't really get in my current phone is like how kind of over processed it still is, even when I'm using this raw output. So I've been using this Haylight application. I don't know if you're aware. And that actually reveals the true kind of raw output. Yeah. And I actually like the look of that quite a bit in my own photos, and then I can later on decide if that specific photo needs noise filtering, and if like that's another thing I hope that this new hardware innovations like IO can improve. Like we would need less that kind of processing to still get good high quality output.
Yeah, I'm guessing, Joran, that with that NCOS implemented in a few years' time, people will still have the choice. The phone makers and the users will still have the choice of producing a processed JPEG or a ProRAW or similar. That won't change. Just that they'll be getting higher quality input data.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So at the end, the smartphone manufacturer or the end user or anyone can still choose to apply every possible technique they do today for picture modifications or adjustments, so that is always possible. But indeed, we give a better input from the start. So it's like you start at the starting point with a Formula One car instead of a regular car. Yeah. But then you can still do whatever you want with it afterwards. And it's also interesting because I've been in another discussion a few months ago where it was about exactly that comparison between the raw versus the completely processed image, and especially with AI now these days, you can even there were like messages where why do you even need a camera, because you can start asking AI, create me a picture of me and my family at Times Square, and it will basically do that, and the picture will look perfect. But the problem is the emotion and the authenticity is completely gone. Yeah. So there is also now a trend to actually get more authenticity and the emotion essentially back into the picture. And so if we feed it with the most raw, pure data at the start, you can also leverage that. And I think from a creating memories point of view with pictures, the fact that we offer a better input is really the key. And then you can still decide for yourself how AI or how processed you want to make it at the end.
Yeah, I still find, Juha, that some of my favorite photographs I've taken ever of people were with this. And I've got some shots taken in broad daylight, but using fill-in flash with the Xenon flash to highlight shadows in people's faces. Like, amazing photographs. And this is a 2013 phone. That's 13 years ago now. In the modern age, I've been having unprocessed shots. I've got the Sony Xperia 1 Mark V here, and Sony's image processing is fairly gentle. And yeah. I think you might also like that, Juha, in terms of...
I need to... To check it out if I can switch away from this ecosystem. But I had to say, I actually, I was browsing through my old photos and I was thinking, hey, what was the SLR I was using in this? Because they look so nice. Yeah. And then it was actually 808. and of course, it was not amazing in low light without the flash. So put the kind of a bright light, like this kind of typical yeah. indoor conditions and bright light. They were something that you really don't get with these current phones with this kind of a filtered output. So one nostalgia thing is like this using the fill-in flash and later on adjusting how much flash you eventually have in the output image. That was like the really thing I would miss. I would really like to say in the existing smartphones as well.
Absolutely. I would point you to, you had, by the way, just entirely by the side, to my Symbian Museum. I've started a set of pages on my website where I could look back at classic Nokia and UIQ, but mainly Symbian-based smartphones. And of course, the 808 has a big slot there. Also the N8 and the N86. Was the N86 before your time?
No, I was in there. I think my first phone was like I was involved in the N70. I joined Nokia in 2004. So I wasn't part of the very first smartphones, but since 2004, I was involved in the image sensor part already.
There we are. So I recommend listeners also go and check out my Symbian Museum. Lots of famous Juha involvement smartphones. Sorry to distract from all the NCOS by going back in time.
No worries.
It'd be lovely to have you on. Hopefully we'll put lots of links in the podcast show notes to IO and anything else you want to promote or pages, then do send me an email. Okay. So thank you very much for joining us. It's been lovely seeing you both.
Yes, likewise. Nice to meet you.
All right, bye for now. So there we go. I hope you enjoyed that and it gave you a glimpse and a taste of what's to come in the phone imaging world. PSC will be back with 896 very, very soon. Ted and Joe carrying on excellent work, keeping PSC going up to show 1000 and maybe even beyond. I'm really enjoying the rebirth and I hope you are too. And I will speak to you hopefully on PSC 900 when I promise to appear again and perhaps in one of the upcoming PSC Live. Bye for now.